Pure Dog Talk is the podcast on purebred dogs. We talk to the legends in the sport and give you tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Pure Dog Talk is sponsored by ChampionshipBreeders.com. Championship Breeders is a proud supporter of the American Kennel Club, our specialty and all breed clubs, our dog sports, and the gifts of therapy and service from our canine companions. I wanted to visit with you a little bit about basically being a professional handler in this sport for a good length of time and your experiences when women handlers weren't as common as they are today.
I kind of got into it by the back door. I majored in animal husbandry, so I was looking for a job long about 1954 that was something that I would be interested in and that somebody'd hire me for. And I was looking, and the world was not clamoring for female animal husbandmen. And someone told me about this lady in Middleburg who wanted to raise Basenjis. So I went and had a talk with her, and sounded kind of interesting to me. And I had always been interested in show dogs. As an army brat, we weren't in a position to raise dogs or have more than a couple. So she bought two Basenjis at that point from England. Then she arranged to get four more, and that was the beginning of Bettina's Basenjis in Middleburg.
Yeah, in the 50s, this was a new breed. I mean, really not many in this country at all, right?
Pretty new. Yeah, the very first, I believe, came in 41. So there was never any competition. I mean, I can well remember in the group having the judge come and go right past you. They'd look at the dog in front of me and the dog behind me and not touch the Basenji. So that was kind of the beginning of it.
Yeah, that's a lot of time in the breed. And so did then you started handling after you started with Basenjis then?
Yeah, after I was there for 3 years, and then it was time for me to move on. My folks were living in Alexandria, so I went back home and started really looking for a job. And I got one at the National Institutes of Health in what we call the Mouse House. It was animal production, and not actually experimenting on them, but providing the animals that they needed to test vaccines or whatever they were doing. So I went there, and I really just managed. That whole business was quite dynamic, so it went from just kind of plain old animals. We had inbred mice that were as many as 200 generations of brother-sister mating, which we don't do in dogs normally.
No.
No. And this was done on purpose, and pedigrees kept on them, and we had many different animal models for human diseases. So we had mice, rats, guinea pigs, hamsters, and rabbits, and that was what I did. I was then able to sort of really think about the dog showing, and Bettina Ward, whose kennel it was, gave me my first Basenji. And finished her at the garden in 57. That's pretty exciting.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, I always wanted a champion, something. My first love was boxers. In fact, we took two when Dad was ordered to Germany. We talk about Coles to Newcastle, taking boxers to Germany. But we brought them back with us, and we did have one litter once down at Fort Monroe. I mean, nobody knew about boxers. That's just the one soldiers brought back with them when they came from Germany. So, of course, we had a litter of nine, and that's the sure way in the Army to get orders. Either plant a garden or have puppies. And then, sure enough, Dad was ordered to Washington, and we brought the last couple, three puppies up with us and ended up keeping one, so that was enough. And, you know, they were just kind of like backyard breeding. I mean, I bought the bitch from a respectable person, but it wasn't anything fancy. But I couldn't afford something fancy. We just pottered along and learned a little bit about showing a dog and looking for a job. And that's what supported it and me. I was there for 33 years.
Oh, my gosh. At the Mouse House?
Yeah. Well, during that time of great change, it went into pathogen-free animals where everything was hysterectomy-derived and super clean into a pathogen-free barrier. And, you know, it was a different thing than it had started. Everything got really cleaned up. Yeah, it was interesting. I followed the same lines, I guess, as dog breeding, but we had a geneticist who did all the smart stuff. I made it work, you know, supplied the sterile equipment, all the caging and all the food and bedding and uniforms for the people, and they showered into the area and put on all this sterile stuff, and it was pretty nifty. And we didn't do anything to the animals, which I liked fine. But I would rather have them practice on animals before they get to me. So.
And so were you showing dogs at the same time you were working at the research lab?
Well, yeah, I was. And I just kind of eased into it a little bit, a dog or two, and it helped me be able to show one of my own, which I did. And I had only two litters, I guess, one, and I kept a nice dog and finished him, and he sired a litter that was up in Connecticut. So I went up and looked at that litter and picked two out of it, and the dog turned out to be a prepotent sire, and I think he's still like about number five or six, and there have been many of them that have really gone at it and had lots and lots of litters, which I never did do, just maybe one a year or one in 2 years. So I didn't get these vast numbers, I'm happy to say.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And so which dog was that? What was his name?
It was Reveille Recruit. And when my first group with him in Philadelphia, I was so excited I almost burst. And my mother was away, and I kind of forgot, and I called, and I told my dad about it, and he said, well, that's good, isn't it?
Yep, that's good, Dad.
Yeah. Yep, that's it. It was good.
And so you were showing dogs on the East Coast in your area in the late 50s and through the 60s. You had to have been in competition with some pretty tough folks back there.
Yeah, probably too dumb to know it, though. I was too dumb to know it. It wasn't so tough in Basenji's because nobody else had them. And they were beginning to get some. There were two fellows that lived up in the Poconos that had storybook Basenjis, and we went 1 year to Harrisburg, I believe it was, because they were going to go, and it was 5 points in Basenjis it was going to be. And we went up to New York to see for a private showing of Goodbye, My Lady.
Oh, yes.
And then we started off in a great snow from New York, and everybody was all over the highways, and we had these three wild Africans that were just took them in the hotel and tried to hold one down in bed while I slept, and was so slick. I mean, you couldn't stand up outside without holding on to the car. It was just miserable. So by the time we got to Harrisburg, we found that the competition was stuck at home. So after all this business, we plodded home with our ones we had, and I won't ever forget it.
Definitely stands out.
Yeah, and that was the biggest competition that we were going to have, and then we didn't get it. So it gradually, people began to get to know the breed, and they were tougher in those days. And I think people didn't really know how to deal with them, but I think we've done a great deal for temperaments.
And do you think that the African dogs that came back, do you think that helped kind of modulate the temperament?
I think it helped. And some of them that didn't get much attention or weren't handled so well by the people that had them, they didn't help very much as far as temperament went. But the one that, when we went, John Kirby was the leader of our safari and has been the stem winder behind each one of them. When we got back, we came back here to my house while they had a few hours layover at Dulles. And he said, we decided, John ought to decide who was going to keep what. And he said, well, you keep Bleaky Gamer, and I almost died.
Yeah.
Yep, she was the one.
Was she the one that had puppies?
No, she was a little brindle bitch. And she was probably the oldest, except for the mom that had the puppies. She was maybe 6 months, we guessed. But she was just perfect. the only one I ever left just loose in the house, unsupervised. And I think she tasted one rug once, a little bit, and never did a wrong thing, you know? I mean, I'd take her walking in the woods, and she'd stick by me, and she was wonderful. So,
is she behind a lot of your dogs today? Were you able to breed down from her?
Not a lot, but a little bit. But I only had two litters from her, where other people have done many more. And, of course, everybody was interested, but they weren't sure whether they wanted to tackle this or not. So everybody was interested in a brindle bitch. Well, she had six boys.
Isn't that always the way?
Well, that was certainly five brindle and one red. Yeah, that was a big disappointment. And then next time I bred her to something I had here, and it wasn't spectacular, but he wasn't spectacular. So I think it took maybe a little while. That one bitch that had the puppies the night that we got her, Susan Coe ended up with her, and I think she had three champions from her, you know, first generation.
Wow.
Which was,
that's very impressive.
When we got her, she looked pretty fat and uncomfortable, but we only had two crates, and we had the puppies that we gotten into put in those. So we just, Stan Carter and I rode the passenger seats, and we just put her on the seat bench between us. And when we got out for anything, she never budged. She said, "I got it made." And she was just right there, not like a Sinji that, I mean, you can't go through a door without everybody trying to be right there. She was something. And we brought her back that night. Somebody thought she'd be about a week. And, of course, that night she had him, and Stan Carter came and tapped on my door, and we were in a serum, and he says, "Damer, we're having puppies." This is like about 4 a.m, and, of course, no electricity. We were staying at John Vaught's house. He was our leader in there, and if they had any electricity, they had it like from 6 to midnight or something like that. So there we were by candlelight, and she was popping out these puppies that is gold, and we brought her back with them, and they were just days, like a couple old, and she came fine.
That's just amazing.
They were so adaptable. That was the thing that I thought was wonderful, and that we all did. Of course, there was no newspaper to put in the crates, so we just put dried banana leaves, and that worked okay. And they, John had brought a lot of just bags of food, like Science Diet or whatever the kibble was, you know, scarfed it up, and they never had a problem. And they drank when you gave them water, and we took them out. They were all leash broken within a day. They just come trucking along with you, and they've kind of unlearned that, I think.
Well, I think it's amazing. It speaks to the basic temperament of the dogs in Africa. And can you talk a little bit, not everybody knows the story, what was the impetus for the Basenji Club of America to allow you guys to bring these dogs back and incorporate them into the AKC's registration?
Well, it was for health reasons. We found that we had a couple of real problems, the first being a hemolytic anemia, which is pyruvate kinase deficiency. And it was babies, you could almost tell by looking at their gums that they were not destined to hang around, and they didn't. They did develop a test for that. That was a wonderful thing. And then we got this identified.
The Fanconi?
The Fanconis, yeah. And Dr. Bouvet up at University of Pennsylvania worked on it for a long time and didn't really come up with anything till Dr. Johnson out at University of Missouri. And he developed the definitive test for it. So none that we brought back, once we were had a test, they were all okay. And of course, we've been wondering, are we ever going to get anything else that's going to pop up? You know, it makes you wonder whether it's what they eat or what it is that makes these things happen. That, instead of us all blindly going along, not knowing what we were doing, now we have tests. And somebody asked me the other day, does everybody test? And I said, everybody that's anybody. I mean, anybody that's a good breeder tests. And you test for about everything you can.
Did the African dogs help? Did they just open up the pedigrees enough to help clear that? Or how did that incorporate?
No, I didn't have it to add to it. So if you didn't breed anybody that had that problem anyway, we just pretty much eliminated, I think. I think they just enlarged the gene pool, and particularly, I think, shoulders. They had nice shoulders. Somebody said to me one time, well, why are you always worrying about the shoulders? I said, well, I think that's pretty important. And it's not just Basenji's that had a problem with it. All you got to do is go to a show and look.
It was Annie Clark, I think, that said that front end's the hardest thing to get and the easiest thing to lose.
Sure is, yeah.
And so when you started showing dogs, and you're a professional handler, still a member of PHA, correct?
Still a member of PHA, yep. I think I was number three, and the other two quit, the flowers on them. Anyhow, I unjoined when I stopped being able to show my own dogs even, so... And so Sue Whaley said, come on, keep on. We need you in the PHA. So I said, okay. So I stayed. And I even finished a dog a couple of weeks ago. It was very small. It was a Toy Fox Terrier. But...
Kelly said you finished a Toy Fox Terrier. I think that's great.
Yeah. Can't run, but and just figured if I could walk around the ring and not fall down, that was a good thing. So... That worked okay.
So, Damra, when you started showing dogs, how many women handlers were there at that time in the late 50s?
Not very many. And I was very small time. I never took a bunch. If I had two or three dogs extra other than one of my own, then that was enough to take care of and enough to be busy. And that was about all I had time to take proper care of when I was leaving home at 6:30 in the morning. Or maybe 7 on a good day. I had to commute a fair distance, and then after I moved out here to the boonies, it was 42 miles, and there was pretty much that before, but I'm out in the country, and it was awfully nice to come home to, and it still is.
Absolutely. So who were kind of your people that you looked up to when you started showing dogs?
Well, I always looked up to the Big Annie. The woman that I worked for with Basenji's, she was a real animal-y also. She was August Belmont's granddaughter, and she hunted, and I mean, she was pretty savvy about lots of things. We kind of learned about showing dogs together. There weren't really any mentors. I mean, I don't think anybody was trying to help you much. So, I mean, I always had a Basenji or two to show, and then I got real interested in Border Terriers because I showed for Marion DuPont Scott, and so I had hers for quite a long time and did a little bit of breeding for her, and then after she died, I kept on for a while with the Borders, and I've always been interested and have shown quite a few really nice ones. Of course, it doesn't get easier doing coats when you get a little arthritis.
No, it doesn't, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Do you have a favorite story that we can share in our in closing so that people can kind of live the good old days a little bit?
Well, probably not. I haven't thought about it. But, you know, I still love it all these many years later. It's still interesting, and it's challenging. I mean, there's a lot to think about if it's getting entries in on time and you do it the old-fashioned way and where you're going to stay and how you're going to get there and who the dogs are. But I think all those things help keep it interesting and challenging.
Never a dull moment.
No, there isn't. And I must say, I don't like to drive as much as I used to. Probably don't do it as well either, but...
Well, that's hard because driving is a big part of the job.
Yeah, it is. I marvel at what some of them do, but I never was a night person. I went with Annie a couple of times, and I learned I wasn't that kind of traveler. I mean, they'd get somewhere at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and I want to be in bed at 10 o'clock. So I think I took my first Basenji from Bettina. I called her Chipmunk. She was Bettina's Feta, which I believe means money in Swahili. Anyway, I took her along, and she was in the room with us, and we like our regular hours. And I don't sleep well a long time in the morning either, which is a good thing, I think. But with that group, they drive into the night and sleep all morning when they could, and I couldn't, so... Had to do that on my own afterwards. And as I said, I just pottered along with a few dogs, and that was good enough. And we got the first Mastiff from my mother in 1956 after Dad retired, and she had had a housebreaker once down at Fort Monroe, and I had my first Boxer then, and she was young, and Mom was writing letters upstairs in her bedroom when she heard something in the house, and she said, well, I better find out. And then when she started off, the dog crawled out from under her bed and went with her, and she stopped for her pistol and stood at the, and this is on an army post, mind you.
Yes.
And yeah, you're so safe. And she, the stairway went down into a big center hall, and she's, and there were two doors on the right, and she saw a flicker of cloth in the door on the center on the right, which was the den, and she had called down and said, who's down there in the house? And nobody answered, and that's when she saw that somebody was there. So she fired to let him know she was armed, and the shots just went bang, bang. He shot right back up at her.
Oh, my gosh.
And, yeah, hit the Boxer right in the chest, and Mom hit the ground, and she called the MPs and said, somebody's broken in the house. And then she was worried that they'd come in and somebody would get shot. So she went around. It was a funny layout in the house. It was a double living room, and it was upstairs, and four bedrooms with a bath in between each pair. And called down to tell him that he was armed, and they never got him. And they thought, here's this crazy woman that shot her own dog.
Oh, no.
So they took a .45 out of the dog and her .32 out of the wall. And she said she wasn't aiming at him. She just wanted to give him a little warning. She didn't miss him by a whole lot. But
it's fabulous. So, Tamara, tell us a little bit about your jewelry. Just to close off our interview, I wanted to talk, you make some beautiful artwork.
Well, mostly it's the sculpture is what I've done of, and dogs, because that's what I know the shape of. And Dad was ordered to Europe, but I had a year of college yet to go. And then when I got back there in 52, then he got a week's notice orders back home to the Pentagon. So I stayed on. My mother kicked me out of the nest and said, you better go to Paris. So I said, okay. That was wonderful time. So I'd to stay there over the winter. And I was interested in sculpture, and I looked around to see if I could find somebody that did animals. And I found a wonderful elderly gentleman who was, I say elderly, now I've changed my attitude about 72. Just a kid of 72. He didn't just teach, he sculpted, and that's what he did. And so he said, well, bring me something of what you've done and just some drawings. And then he said he'd take me on. And so I did that like three afternoons a week for a couple of months while I was there. And I stayed through Christmas. So when I came back home, of course, that's when I was looking for a job. I worked on a farm for a little while and found out what I didn't want to do the rest of my life. Got to milk the cow and ring hogs and all kinds of... I looked like Charles Atlas by the end of the summer. So I said, I can't do this. So I didn't. That's when I started, I guess, in 59, working for Uncle Sam at NIH. And that's where I stayed from then on. And but the sculpture I kind of didn't do for a while, and then I got interested in really doing some. And I've been trying to make myself still do it, but I think I've hit the end of it, because I could if I... But I think I've gotten less efficient. There's not as much time to do things. You know, when I was working and commuting that distance and keeping the dogs, and even though my mama cooked and somebody else shopped and that stuff, it was pretty busy and you didn't have time to do a lot. But I got into it a bit, and it sure is fun.
Beautiful, beautiful pieces that I've seen the photos of.
Well, good. It's been a lot of fun doing them. And most of them, you know, for somebody or for either a trophy or a dog. I think one of the most fun ones was when I did the Irish Water Spaniel Aristocrats. The group of people wanted to do something for Bill Traynor, and they asked him if he'd rather have the money or have me do something of aristocrat. And so he said he'd like that. And so that's what I did. And I have one myself, and he at the dog museum, you know, the AKC archivist at the time, and I should remember her name, but she got one for there in New York. But it's kind of fun. I said to the foundry, can you drip a little plastic or something? Because it's from a picture that Bill loved of her standing on the dock, and she was all wet. And so it has, they got some drips on it, and it looks nifty,
oh,
I think.
Wow, that's amazing. That is incredible. Okay, so we're going to give our closing speech. What is your long-held, well-considered advice to the future exhibitors, to these new folks that are coming in? What do you say? How do they succeed? What's their best way to move forward?
Well, mostly it's the young people that, I mean, most people don't need any advice, but I tell them, go to school first and get that out of the way, because then you have something to fall back on or do while you're starting off handling, because you have to have clients in order to be a successful handler. And the main thing you do is take care of the dogs. It's not all full of glamour and going in the ring, and the scut work is 95% of it, and keeping them well and healthy. And then you learn about the presenting them the best way you can, and go to shows and watch and see who does a really good job and see why they do what they do. Work hard.
There you go. Work hard. It is a hard job.
It's hard on your body, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, ma'am. Tell us how old you are now that you just finished the most recent dog, Tamara.
85.
Good job.
Yeah.
You are a hero to all of us. Well, Tamara, thank you so much for joining us on Pure Dog Talk today.
Well, thanks for being interested. I hope it does somebody some good. And thanks for putting up with me.
As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. This will help share the love with others out there in the sport. This has been Pure Dog Talk with your host, Laura Reeves. We hope you can join us next time as we continue on the journey to success with your purebred dog.